Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum webinar as today, January 27th, 2022, we host a litigation update on New York's Rent Stabilization Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the Federalist Society. Pleased to welcome you today. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, which is being recorded and will likely be transcribed and posted on the Federalist Society's website and as many other venues as we can manage. I'm very pleased to welcome our guest speaker today, return guest, Andy Pincus. He's a litigating partner at the Mayer Brown Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C., and he represents the plaintiffs in the case we're going to be talking about. He's going to give us some opening remarks, 15 or 20 minutes or so, but then, as always, we'll be looking to you for audience questions. If you have those in mind, we'll be using the Q&A function at the bottom center of your screen. If you could get us your questions in that fashion, that would be most helpful. But with that, Andy Pincus, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Dean, and thank you and the Federalist Society for inviting me to talk about what I think is a quite interesting and important case. To set the stage, it's really critical to understand the scope of the New York law. I think people hear rent regulation or a rent law, and they think, well, that's just a law that's regulating rent levels. But the New York law does much more than that. It's been proudly described by its supporters as the most stringent set of regulations in history, and it is. And that's particularly true after the 2019 amendments that greatly increased the restrictions imposed by the law. So this New York law rests on an every 3 year declaration of a housing emergency by the New York City Council, something that's happened like clockwork for the past 50 years. Property owners who are subject to the law effectively lose control of the property. The purpose and effect of the law really is to commandeer that property in perpetuity for use as rental units controlled by the government. And so let me just tick off a couple of the restrictions that apply. First of all, the property owner must renew the lease unless the tenant engages in misconduct, essentially legal violations. And also, not just for the tenant to whom the property owner initially rents the apartment, the law provides that the property owner has to accept successors. They can be the tenant's relatives or caregivers, and then those successors are allowed the same renewal in perpetuity rights. I like to use the illustration, people may remember Friends. Monica lived in her grandmother's apartment. I actually thought that that was not an accurate depiction of the law, but it's true. If you move in when a relative is there and you stay for a prescribed amount of time, then you basically take over, as she did, the right to have a rent-stabilized apartment and all of the renewal rights. The property owner can't refuse to renew for his own use or her own use or for the use of a family in a small building, for example. If a property owner wants to have an elderly relative or younger or children live in an apartment in the building, unless they can meet a very high standard, and only then one apartment per building. The property owner can't change the use from residential to commercial rental. The property owner can't convert the building to a condominium without permission of 51% of the tenants, even if the conversion would allow the tenants to stay in place. The property owner can't demolish the building without finding housing for tenants at the same or lower rent in the neighborhood. And that's led to property owners essentially making very, very large payoffs when they have a need to demolish the building. Also, the off-ramps that used to exist to eliminate these controls don't exist anymore. There's no vacancy decontrol. At some point, New York has said if the apartment becomes vacant, it can be not subject to rent this rent regulation scheme anymore. That doesn't happen. There used to be a decontrol if the tenant had a high income or the rent reached high levels, or even if both of those existed. Now, none of that. The government in this case, the government defendants tout the owner's ability to leave the apartments vacant when and if a tenant and all of her successors have left. But that's hardly a benefit to say, good news, you get to have your property vacant and you can't make any money from it. So far, I've talked about the restrictions that sort of lock the property in to rent, to renting and deprive the owner of the control over who lives there. But I don't want to ignore regulation of rent levels, because that too is pretty draconian. By New York's own calculation, owners' costs have increased at twice the rate of permitted rent increases. And the law imposes very, very severe limitations on the owner's ability to recoup improvements to units. You can imagine, given the automatic renewal rights and the ability, the requirement of continuing to rent to successors, these apartments don't become vacant very frequently. When they do, landlords would like to upgrade them. They often need upgrades because of the length of time that's elapsed. The law imposes the limit on the ability to recoup those investments, $15,000 every 5 years, far less than what's needed when a lengthy tenantship ends. And there's also a significant and very low limit on the amount that can be recouped for building-wide improvements. And finally, you know, the complaint explains, based on government data, and it won't surprise anyone given the restrictions that I've listed, that rent-stabilized properties are worth from 25 to 50% less than non-regulated properties. And that study that we rely on was done before the 2019 amendments to the law, which we calculate impose another 15% reduction. So that sort of sets the stage of the law. Let me talk a little bit about our claims. We have four basic claims that we've advanced in this case that assert constitutional challenges to this New York regime. One is that it constitutes a physical taking. The courts have defined a physical taking as a government-authorized, non-consensual physical occupation of property. If a plaintiff can establish that, that's automatically a compensable taking. There's no balancing test. The only question is how much compensation is owed. And in our view, that's exactly what the rent stabilization law does. It effectively takes over the property, forces it to be rented in perpetuity, tenants for a lifetime, successors. The owner can't pick the tenant, or indeed, as a practical matter, is effectively barred from changing the use. So we think that is a classic physical taking. We also make a regulatory taking argument. As people, I think, know, there are different flavors of regulatory takings. We assert two. The first is because the New York law sets rent levels based in part on the tenant's ability to pay, it violates the takings clause. This is not a typical kind of price control. As I'm sure people in this audience know, price controls typically say we're going to allow the controlled seller of the good or of the service to recover her costs plus a reasonable rate of return, but we want to limit the charge to that level. Here, there's an additional factor that the government has to take into account, which is tenant ability to pay. And we think that violates the takings clause based on a theory that Justices Scalia and O'Connor spelled out in a separate opinion in an old Supreme Court case called Pinnell that involved a rent regulation law. They said laws are takings when they force a selected group of property owners to bear burdens that should be borne by the public at large. And in traditional land use, there's a cause and effect between the regulation and the social evil to be remedied. Zoning, for example, is a classic example. You know, the property, the uses of the property that zoning seeks to prohibit are the things that are the harm that the government seeks to prevent. But where the use of the property isn't the source of the problem, they said, it can't be burdened. And that's particularly true of providing housing for low-income people. That's not something that these landlords have caused. They haven't caused the ability of people to have lower incomes or to not have enough money for rent. That's a societal problem caused by all kinds of things. And so we say that this theory, which wasn't addressed by the majority in Pinnell or by a subsequent Supreme Court, is an open issue and that it is directly applicable to the New York scheme. We also make a more traditional regulatory taking argument using the multi-factor test that the court laid out first in Penn Central and has applied in a bunch of other cases. And here, all of those factors weigh in favor of taking. There's the nature of the intrusion. It's a physical invasion of the property, as I've discussed, essentially commandeering it and forcing upon the owner tenants not chosen by the owner. There's a significant reduction in value and interference with investment-backed expectations. There is not the factor that sometimes justifies government regulation, which is preventing noxious uses or harmful uses of property. And finally, there's no reciprocal benefit. You know, the classic justification for zoning is, although I'm burdened because my property is zoned residential, I get the benefit of the fact that my neighbor's property is zoned residential, and therefore I won't have an asphalt plant built next to my property. And that reciprocal benefit is something that the courts have frequently pointed to justify government regulations. Here, there is no reciprocal benefit. These property owners who are directly regulated by the RSL don't get any benefit from it. Finally, we make a due process argument. Hard to win, obviously, under the current rational relationship test, but we think the RSL, the rent law here, is far from satisfying any legitimate government objective. Sometimes it's talked about as a benefit for low and middle income families, but there's no targeting here. And in fact, there have been many studies and newspaper articles identifying very wealthy people who live in rent-stabilized apartments and are getting the benefit of them. And in fact, the government, the New York government eliminated, as I said earlier, decontrol based on tenants' high incomes. So if anything, that confirms that there's no targeting here of lower middle-income people. Sometimes it's the law is justified as dealing with a housing shortage. It's designed to make sure apartments are available, but it actually exacerbates a housing shortage, every economist will tell you, because it prevents, for example, the rebuilding on properties where the whole zoning envelope has not been used. It prevents the construction of new units. It also, because regulation is something of a zero-sum game, if this is depressing rents in stabilized apartments, non-regulated apartment rents are rising. So it's hurting people in a significant way. Finally, the argument that the defendants have really landed on is a contention that this provides for neighborhood stability. But again, it exacerbates a housing shortage. And that stability really is another word for a discriminatory effect. Older tenants who happen to get there have the benefit of this housing. Because of the low rent and the low increases permitted, they tend to stay in apartments that may be larger than they need, and that's hurting lots of people who need those apartments. So those are our four claims. We're asserting them on a facial basis. These laws and regulations apply across the board to all rent-stabilized properties and impose burdens on all of them that in our view, amount to a constitutional violation. So with that stage set, let me talk a little bit about where we are. The district court dismissed our case. We weren't surprised by that. There have been a number of prior challenges that have been heard in New York and ultimately went to the Second Circuit. We think those precedents have been undermined significantly by more recent Supreme Court decisions, as I'll talk a little bit about. But the district court relied largely on those, and also the argument that notwithstanding the very detailed allegations of our complaint, there wasn't enough to assert a facial claim on the regulatory takings front. And on the due process side, the court said, understood our arguments, but said, given the low standard, he had to find due process satisfied. So now we're in the Court of Appeals. The case is fully briefed. There'll be an oral argument on February 16th. And we've gotten very strong support from amici who we're grateful, recognize the importance of the issue that we're raising. 10 amicus briefs in all, they fall into two categories, some national and New York industry groups, realtors, apartment owners, home builders, even some apartment associations from California, because rent regulation is a serious issue there. And then a number of the leading U.S. groups that will be familiar to this audience who advocate for the protection of property rights, the Pacific Legal Foundation, Cato, the Institute for Justice, the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Our other sides, the other side, I think its supporters recognize the importance of the case. They've got amicus briefs as well, multiple briefs from unions, tenant groups, and professors. We think we've got strong legal position. I'm happy to delve into whatever people would like to talk about, but maybe I'll just talk quickly about the physical taking argument, because I think that's where the law is particularly clear. The Supreme Court years ago decided a case called Yee that dealt with the rental of property for use for the positioning of mobile homes. And in that case, the court said it rejected a physical taking argument. The argument was made by the property owners because the statute allowed one mobile home owner to essentially transfer the lease to another. The property owner there said, our right to exclude, to control who enters our property is infringed upon because we can't control who rents. The court said, rejected that argument, but it cited as extremely important the fact that under that regulatory scheme, the property owner could withdraw the property from the rental market with about 6 months or relative in a relatively short period of time. That obviously sharply distinguishes that case from ours, where for the reasons I've described, the property is effectively commandeered for the long term. So we think Yee actually supports our position, although the other side relies on it to a significant degree. The other case that is very supportive is the Horn case.
Andy, can I interrupt you just briefly?
Sure.
In your opening remarks, you cited a number for how long, and this goes to the Yee analysis, how long these emergency powers have been used. Did you say 15 years or 50 years?
55-0.
Okay. Okay, good. Sorry to interrupt, but that...
No, since the enactment of the law of the authority to impose these regulations, like clockwork, the emergency has been found to continue and not to have been remedied by the law, which is sort of interesting. If your legitimate government purpose for this law is that it's going to ameliorate a housing shortage and it hasn't done it in 50 years, there's sort of an interesting question about how sensible that linkage really is. But yes, 50 years is how long this has lasted. So let me, the Horn case, people may remember, involved raisins and a government regulatory program that required raisin owners to essentially give part of their crop to the government. And in that case, the federal government argued no taking here because you don't have to be in the raisin business. And if you're in the raisin business, you've essentially voluntarily acquiesced to the government taking part of your crop. And the court gave relatively short shrift to that argument and said, we can't condition people being in the raisin business on something that would otherwise be a taking. Here, a large part of the government defendant's argument is once you decide to be in the rental market, the government can do whatever it wants in terms of limiting your right to exclude or to take your property back. So we think Horn is a strong case. But since we filed our brief, and we've now just recently filed supplemental briefs on this, as this audience probably knows, the Supreme Court decided two cases involving takings claims, Cedar Point and Pactel, and they provide additional strong support, we think, for our position. Cedar Point, of course, addressed the takings challenge to a California law that permitted union organizers to enter farms for up to 3 hours a day, 120 days a year. And the Court of Appeals in that case had said no physical taking because the right to enter wasn't 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And it said anything less has to be analyzed as a regulatory taking. The Supreme Court reversed, held it was a physical taking, emphasized the importance of the right to exclude, and that interference or physical appropriation of property by the government for itself or a private party violates the takings clause because of the interference with the right to exclude. And it said that's exactly what happened here. The government was basically taking a segment of a property owner's right to exclude and saying, we, the government, require you to allow these people to enter onto your property, even though you don't want them to. That significantly expanded the category of physical takings, we think, or made clear what we think the category is. The defendants in our case had made exactly the same argument that the quote that was rejected in Cedar Point. They said, because the rent stabilization law isn't permanent and doesn't completely eviscerate the right to exclude, it isn't a physical taking. Obviously, that argument is off the board. And we think the law does exactly what Cedar Point says is prohibited. It interferes with the property owner's right to control who enters the property for the reasons that I've given. You can't decide who the tenant is. You can't change the use, et cetera. So all of those restrictions have the purpose and effect of forcing owners to rent to tenants, whether that owner wants to or not. Cedar Point also rejected the argument that the law there was a longstanding background restriction on property. There, the law had been in effect since 1975. And the court said, when we talk about background restrictions, we're talking about the fundamental common law restrictions, not restrictions that have been imposed by government that are in addition to those restrictions. And of course, that, again, is exactly what the rent regulation is here. Finally, the Pactel decision, which was a summary reversal by the court, was a challenge to a San Francisco law that conditioned the ability of people who owned property as tenants in common, apartment buildings, tenants in common, to change to a condominium structure. They said you can do that, but you have to give a lifetime lease to anyone who's a tenant. That was claimed to be a physical taking. The lower court rejected it. The Supreme Court, in addition to overturning an exhaustion ruling that the Court of Appeals had erroneously imposed, remanded that case for application of Cedar Point to those arguments about physical taking. So bottom line, we think these decisions provide additional very significant support for our physical taking argument, and it'll be very interesting to see how the Second Circuit deals with them. So let me stop there, because obviously the most important thing is to address folks' questions and move on to the questions that people have.
Great. Thank you so much, Andy. You set the table really, really well, I think. And my first obvious question is, how do I get one of these rent control apartments?
But it is like a lottery ticket.
Well, it really seems to be so. You mentioned that this has the effect of reducing the value of these properties by 25 to 50%, and maybe another 15% given the age of that study. Is there any evidence in the record about with this in place, I can lease an apartment that would ordinarily cost $4,000 for $2,000, those types of numbers? Like, what is the bottom line for the potential tenants, not on the value of the building, but the monthly lease?
Well, they obviously vary because the increases depend on, right, you know, what the base has been. There's a huge amount of variance, but we one of the things we did in this case was we recognized that because of the Second Circuit precedents that I referred to, that there was a strong likelihood of dismissal in the district court, although we obviously argued that those precedents had been superseded. So we filed a very, very detailed 100-plus page complaint in order to lay things out very clearly in terms of what we think the factual record is. We didn't collect rent levels, but obviously those values, property values, are a direct reflection of what the rent levels are.
Right. Interesting. Interesting. We do have a couple questions, and I'll remind the audience, try to use the Q&A function if you could, if you have a question. I've got other questions of my own. I'm going to ask one more before we turn to the audience, Andy, if you don't mind. And that's about the procedures in the Second Circuit. I'm sure you must be familiar with them by now. Is a panel named for the oral argument? If not, when will that happen? And what's the history of that court? I think it's pretty stingy in terms of going en banc, and I'm getting ahead procedurally here, but just curious.
Well, you find out the panel sort of the week before, so right, we don't know who the panel is yet. B, I think historically there had been a great reluctance for folks to go en banc in the Second Circuit, and many Second Circuit judges had written about that fact. I think with some changes in personnel in recent years, the last couple of years, there have been more frequent en bancs. Hard to tell where that would go with us. We're of course hoping to win before the panel and not have to worry about that.
Yeah, no, of course. I was just curious. I just see a chat here. Somebody says that I'm a New York City landlord. I have a $47 a month rent for a unit worth $4,000 a month. So
that just tells you how, if somebody has been in that property for a very long time and it started out at a low level in 1974 when these controls, 69 and then 74 when they were sort of really solidified, you can have a very, very, very low rent compared to what the market rent is.
It's pretty easy to spend more money a month at Starbucks than on your rent there. Again, use the Q&A if you have a question. The first question I see here is, it sounds like this is essentially a public benefit being provided by private actors, in this case, private owners of private property. Is that correct? And then I would augment that with anything about the plaintiffs, obviously. Is this the typical big guy versus little guy? Are we talking about mega corporations that own skyscrapers full of rent-controlled units? Or is it that plus somebody that owns a brownstone and they're renting out the basement or the second floor or four-unit apartments? What are the equities there?
So just in terms of the scope of the law, this is about pre-1974 buildings of five units or more, of more than five units. So these cover, if you're a New Yorker, as I am, the brownstones that you walk by when I grew up on the west side of Manhattan, that have been turned into rental units. And so many of these buildings are owned by families, their mom and pop landlords. Some of our plaintiffs in this case, in addition to some trade associations, are mom and pop landlords. And so this is not mega real estate owning, skyscrapers that are 65 stories tall. For a large part of this burden is falling on small property owners. And just to get to your question about, is this a public benefit being forced to be provided by private actors? That's not just what it is as a matter of fact. It's what it is in a matter of New York law. The New York Court of Appeals, in a decision in the bankruptcy context, held that rent stabilization, the rent stabilization benefits that a tenant has are public benefits provided by a discrete group of people. And that decision recently was codified by the New York legislature. So we don't have to guess. We have definitive recognition by New York that this is a public benefit, but it's being provided by these small group of this, not small, it's a million apartments, by property owners who've been singled out to provide that benefit and to finance it entirely themselves.
Right. Interesting. And here's a question from a distressed property owner that doesn't want to interfere with your case, but wants to know how he can petition for immediate relief for his right to exclude, meaning that he wants to use his own property for his own primary residence. That's a little bit beyond your case. I don't know if you want to respond to that or if we want to go to the next question.
Well, there have been, and I guess there will be more cases of owners bringing as applied challenges based on their specific circumstances. Owners who, before the law to this 2019 amendments took effect, had put in place renovations, and now, there's nothing more literally a taking than saying, even though you've invested money in your property, we are not going to allow you to recover the value of that investment. That's what this law basically does. Yeah. And so there are people trying to focus on the targeted problems they have. The right to recover for your own use is another significant problem. Well, one of our plaintiffs, wanted to recover a unit because of the need to have a ground floor unit due to some physical disabilities. And this law, as I said, and this became more draconian in 2019, says you cannot refuse to renew unless you can meet an extremely high burden and then only one apartment. So, if you have a five apartment six apartment building, and you know you have elderly parents. You're living in it, but you'd like to have elderly parents move into it so you can be their caregiver. You can't do that. Or you'd like to have your children, you know, live with you. Maybe your children have a grandchild, and you'd like to be the caregiver for that grandchild after school. You can't do those things, and you know that just seems to be an unbelievably direct and obvious interference with what we would consider traditional property rights.
And I suppose reconfiguring your units, if you have a 5-unit brownstone that this applies to, and you try to take down some walls and end up with a 3-bedroom brownstone that might be more marketable, might be better for the neighborhood, that would probably make you a violator of the act, I suppose.
Well, first of all, you'd have to, could only do that, you know, when units are vacant, unless you can meet the very high standard and very significant costs of relocating existing tenants. But then you can't change the use. So even if you do that, your ability to try to recover that, what would be a significant investment, is also capped. Just to give people a sort of a metric, the amount that you can recover for renovating an individual unit is $15,000. Some of these units will have been occupied for 20 years if they happen to become vacant. If you're a diligent property owner, you would like to bring them up to code. That typically takes $50,000 or more, but you can only recover $15,000. And the recovery process, I won't get into the economic details, very low, and similar, very low cap for building-wide improvements. So, you know, I mean, one of the bizarre functions of the law is actually to create an obvious and huge disincentive to bringing buildings up to what a reasonable property owner would want them to be. But also, you know, to take your example, what if you're the zoning envelope on your property would allow you to build an apartment, a building that could have 10 apartments, and you'd like to make that investment, you believe there's a future in the New York market, you can't do that either.
Interesting. And going back to the questions in our Q&A, and if you're in the audience, please feel free to add to these. This goes to your remedies that you're seeking. Is this money damages, an injunction, some combination?
We are not seeking money damages. We are seeking an injunction. We think this law, way beyond anything the Constitution permits, we think it has to be invalidated. We're not naive to believe that the court is going to say there can't be any regulation of rental properties. There can be some, obviously, but it has to be within constitutional constraints. And what we're hoping for and looking for is those guardrails to be established.
Did you look at the state constitution, and is it unfriendly to these claims? I assume these are all federal constitutional claims, all in federal court.
Yeah. And, you know, we could have thought about state law claims, but of course you can't bring state law claims against states in federal court. And we thought for our federal constitutional claims, we really wanted to be in federal court.
Sure.
We're not able to, given that strategic decision to bring state law based claims.
No, that makes perfect sense. You know, a lot of our members, Federal Society members, conservatives and libertarians, they bristle at the idea of the exercise of emergency powers. COVID is a good example where, you know, some people are concerned that if you're able to, as a government entity, able to declare an emergency and then declare its end, and in the meantime have enhanced powers, the incentives line up in a perverse way. Is the city saying anything at all about the span of this, the fact that this is an ongoing and updated emergency every 3 years for 50 years? And do they say something, you know, in the nature of Justice O'Connor, that we would expect this to end in 25 years, like affirmative action, or just business as usual?
No. And in fact, you know, part of the rationale of the proponents of the 2019 amendments was basically cracking down on the ability to move properties out of control was the idea that they wanted to preserve these properties as rental properties. That's sort of the stated, and rental properties subject to these restrictions. So it's interesting that the statute, the necessary condition for an emergency is a less than 5% or less vacancy rate. And then, you know, the statute certainly contemplates additional criteria. New York has really never spelled out what those are. It's quite clear that in New York City, there are areas that don't have, that have a higher vacancy rate. But the city has consistently applied that standard on an across-the-board basis, because the goal clearly has been to ensure that this regime stays in place. You know, if you back up and look at the environment, there were a million of these apartments. The people who have them obviously feel very strongly about the limitations on property owner rights that they have and the benefits to tenants. The people who are in non-regulated apartments, who are bearing the burdens of this for the reasons I said, housing shortage, increased rents, you know, have a less direct benefit. So, you know, if you think about how the sort of overall environment works, you have some very highly motivated constituents who want to keep this regime in place.
Sure. Sure. It always seems to be that way. The next caller question or viewer question, I guess, concerns the reported retirement, upcoming retirement of Justice Breyer and what that might what effect that might have. Of course, he won't retire till the end of the term at the earliest, but this case won't reach the Supreme Court before the end of the term. I remember that in the Cedar Point case, he wrote the dissent, I think, and it was 6-3. So, but go ahead and answer that question if you could.
Yes, he wrote the dissent. You know, obviously we don't know who's going to replace him, and we don't know that person's views, so hard to predict. But, you know, I think the Cedar Point majority and, you know, Cedar Point, if you look at the sort of the court's recent takings jurisprudence, there was Cedar Point, but Cedar Point was preceded by the Nick decision. People will remember that prior under the old Williamson County case, takings claims had to be brought first in state court. If the state had an inverse condemnation remedy, had a remedy for laws that are claimed to affect the taking, Williamson County said you have to first go to state court before you can bring your 1983 case in federal court. And what a surprise, the effect of that was that the state court decision was res judicata of your claim or collateral estoppel. And so effectively, you could never get to federal court or hardly ever on a takings claim. And Nick, in another opinion written by the Chief Justice, as was Cedar Point, said we're not going to continue to allow takings claims to have this second class status compared to every other constitutional claim, which can be brought without an exhaustion requirement directly in federal court under 1983. And so, you know, I think those decisions and Horn, you know, indicate among a number of the justices significant concern with ensuring that the Constitution's protection of property rights gets appropriate scope.
Do the defendants here, do they discuss any of the, I don't know if you call them unintended consequences, they seem to be so many and they're so longstanding, it's hard to say they're unintended anymore. Do they answer to that at all, or just are they silent on some of those unintended consequences?
Well, I think they're, you know, these issues mostly come up under the due process rubric, right? Because that's where you're sort of looking at the government interests that are supposedly furthered. And I think their position is there's a government, they focus on protection of low and middle income people. They focus on preserving, in their terms, rental housing, and they focus on community stability without really spending a lot of time discussing, you know, the obvious ways in which those interests aren't furthered and are in fact harmed by the law. So, you know, what they want to do is sort of paint this as a battle of the experts and say under the low standard rational relationship test under the due process clause, that's all they have to show.
So their defense in court seems to focus on middle and lower class people, although the policy, if I heard you correctly in your opening remarks, it doesn't focus on exclusively.
No. And we quote in our complaint, we quote a number of articles in New York papers, including a study by the Wall Street Journal about the very, not only some very well-known people who are in rent-stabilized buildings, apartments paying very little, but an overall study that shows that a pretty significant percentage of the people who are getting this benefit have quite significant high incomes. Yeah. And I should say, I'll do a little ad, for people who are interested in looking at the pleadings, we have a website called unlawfulrentregs.com that has our filings in the case.
And again, that's unlawfulrentregs.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Unlawfulrentregs.com. So let's say you prevail. What do you get? And then I'm going to go back to another audience question, a fact-specific one.
You know, we think we get a declaration that the law is unconstitutional, and we get reasoning by the court that reaches that conclusion, explaining why the current regime violates the Constitution, and that obviously the declaration and injunction, but also the reasoning, will constrain what New York can do in the future. And you know, our goal is to have a rational New York housing policy that deals with the housing shortage, recognizes that opening the door to building larger properties on these rent-regulated properties. One of the studies that we did and that we summarized in the complaint looked at the extent to which these properties don't use the entire zoning envelope, and it's quite significant. So if there was a greater ability of these property owners to say, you know what, as I said earlier, I'm going to make an investment in New York, I'm going to either add some floors, or obviously, depending on what the engineering permits, I'm going to expand the number of apartments on my property. To do that, obviously, probably have to have an empty building. But I would make that investment. You know, isn't it totally rational that we would want to allow that, and in fact, to incentivize it?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Is there a grandfathering clause here that would prevent somebody from bringing themselves under this regime if they had a 4-unit brownstone and they put a top deck on it and end up with 6 units? Are they then subject to this, or are they grandfathered in?
The building, there are sort of 2 requirements. It has to be a pre-1974 building, okay. And also have the requisite number of units.
Okay, interesting. Interesting. So
there are programs, tax rebate programs and other programs that New York has that say, if you take advantage of this rebate program, you will be subject to rent stabilization. Obviously, that's an entirely different situation from the owners who have had rent stabilization thrust upon them. In some of the post Cedar Point filings by the defendants, they sort of point to those apartments, which are 15% roughly of the million apartments that we're talking about. Obviously, they are a totally different animal than the people who didn't make that choice and just were subject to rent stabilization without any countervailing benefit at all.
Yeah, interesting. I keep saying I'm going back to the audience, but I do. Since we're talking about the remedy here and what you get, you mentioned in your opening, I think, that this is among the most onerous, or perhaps the most onerous, rent control statute in any city. Do you want to get this to the Supreme Court so that you can maybe set a national standard or get some national standards out of the Supreme Court and maybe have an impact in Chicago or Los Angeles or San Francisco or wherever else, maybe even,
similar? Well, our goal is to get relief for our clients. Obviously, the sooner the better, and whatever court we can get it in. Sure. You know, this is a national issue. I don't think it's a coincidence that one of the amicus briefs in our case was from the San Francisco and California apartment associations. It is an issue that is getting, you know, increased discussion, rent regulation around the country as an option, notwithstanding the fact that the economic studies it's amazing. And we quote some quite distinguished economists in the complaint in dealing with these due process rational relationship issues. You know, they're basically, there are very few things that economists agree on. One of them is rent control, rent regulation is bad.
Yeah,
is bad for the market in all kinds of ways. But it seems to be an approach that is getting talked about by government officials and advocacy groups much more in recent, you know, years and days.
Right. Very good. So now back to the audience here. How do you reconcile the appellant's claim that the New York City Rent Guidelines Board has failed to fully compensate them for changes in operating costs, when the RGB's own data shows that owner net operating income has increased over 50%, and that's after adjusting for inflation since 1990. I don't know if you can see these questions, Andy, or not, but that's a bit of a mouthful. How would you respond to that?
I actually don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but obviously net income doesn't deal with all of the expenses that owners, my recollection is the net income number that the RGB uses does not deal with all of the owner's expenses. And it seems to me, and we really haven't had any pushback on this from the defendants, that the most direct comparison is rent increases and what the RGB's own numbers are with respect to cost increases. So that seems to be the most direct comparison. And obviously, net operating income has to be different because their own chart shows the rent increase number increasing at half the rate of their own cost numbers. So that's the reason why the net income operating income number is not a number that includes all costs. And a number of costs that have increased significantly in recent years have been taxes and costs for things like water.
Good. Skipping one question, we'll go back to the emergency declaration. Is there any standard in current law defining an emergency? Under prior law, a vacancy rate determined a vacancy could be declared. I guess an emergency could be declared is what he means. Under prior law, vacancy rate determined an emergency could be declared. What's the basis for this declaration? Who made it? And who keeps
it? It's the City Council of New York, the state legislature sets the sort of rules, and New York does the declaring. The city does the declaring for the applicability.
Is this all five boroughs or Manhattan?
All five boroughs. Yeah. Well, that's one of the issues, as I said earlier. The statute says 5% is a necessary condition for the emergency. It doesn't define the other criteria. And frankly, New York has never defined them. But one of the things we point out in the complaint is that just as a matter of process, there's never been a standard for what the emergency is, what these additional factors are, and not much process has gone into it. Essentially, there's a Census Bureau study that gets done. If it shows the requisite low vacancy rate, the vacancy rate that satisfies the statutory requirement, then there's a hearing, a bunch of people testify, and that's the end of it. You know, as I said earlier, one of the things that's quite strange is that if you look on a borough basis or a neighborhood basis, there are many neighborhoods where the vacancy rate is higher than 5%. But obviously, the proponents of regulation have no incentive to look at this issue on a neighborhood or area basis, because the goal quite clearly has been to keep the regulation in effect. In fact, when it looked like, because of COVID, that there might be a higher vacancy rate in New York, you may remember the stories about people moving out of New York, the survey was delayed and the determination was delayed because of the risk. And there were actually proposals to change the standard out of, I think, because of concern, again, of the proponents of regulation, that standard might not be met anymore.
Right. Interesting. Sticking with the audience for a while now, do you have any evidence that rent-regulated properties have increased in value at a lower rate than properties in unregulated markets elsewhere in the country? Is there that sort of comparative analysis?
We haven't done a comparison between New York properties and other properties, but we did do, and again, this study is described in our complaint, and I see someone's put the link in the chat. We did do a comparison between, in New York, which seems like the best comparison, between regulated and unregulated units based on property tax valuations, and there is a very, very stark difference.
So within Manhattan, if you're regulated versus unregulated, you're increasing or not increasing value at a certain rate.
Well, we didn't do rate. We just did a snapshot, and the snapshot was up to 50% difference.
Right.
In actual absolute value.
Interesting. What are the equities? I mean, I remember in law school, which, you know, I have to rack my brain to remember law school, but there's this idea of coming to the nuisance. If there's a property in an airport path and there's noise, I'm wondering about people who have bought these properties knowing there had been emergencies declared. So they came to the nuisance, basically, I suppose. Is there an aspect of that in this case at all? If I bought it 10 years ago, I bought it presumably at the depressed price. But go ahead.
Well, and there actually is an older Supreme Court case that Justice Scalia wrote the opinion for the court called Palazzolo that addresses that issue. And what the court said is, you know, we're not going to allow takings to essentially be, they didn't use this term, but laundered by the mere fact that somebody, that the property has changed hands. And so we think that's a very strong argument that again, the fact that someone buys after the regulation does not allow the government to continue to impose a regulation that would have been a taking vis-a-vis the initial owner.
Yeah, interesting. This question goes to tax benefits. And is there an argument that can be made regarding the fact that some of the owners receive very substantial tax benefits for creating or preserving rent-stabilized apartments while others get nothing for providing the same benefit?
Yes, as I say, I think the tax benefit, we are not advancing claims on behalf of people who are subject to rent stabilization because of the tax benefits we received. These are people who didn't have a choice. They own buildings that qualify. They didn't get any countervailing tax or other benefit. They just get the burdens.
Yeah.
And as I said, that category is about 15% or so of the total apartment. So it's not negligible, but the lion's share of the people, of the property owners burdened by this have not gotten any benefit at all.
Yeah. Here's a fact-specific question. I'm looking at one from Edward Hockman, it looks like. And again, Andy, I don't know if you can read these or not. If you're
reading them. No, I have it on my screen.
Yeah, he says he chaired the New York City Guidelines Board for 7 years, and rent regulation is a Byzantine system. First, a comment. When I was chair, there were approximately 7,400 apartments where there were more bedrooms than tenants. Usually an elderly couple or widow whose kids had grown up and spouse had died, but it would cost the remaining spouse or couple more money to move into a smaller, less desirable unit. Talk about your unintended consequences. My question is, what is the strongest argument which the other side has?
First of all, on that comment, I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the reasons, it's another one of the irrational consequences of these laws, is that people are using apartments that newcomers to New York, would be more sensibly allocated to, but they can't get them. And so it's actually, the argument is we're helping to alleviate the housing shortage. No, you're not. You're actually making it worse by having this misallocation between apartment size and tenant, and also severely disadvantaging newcomers vis-a-vis people who have been there for a while. So again, just on the irrationality, the strongest argument on the other side, I don't think, especially post Cedar Point, I think they have a very hard time on the physical takings side of the equation. Even the Yee decision that said, we're not going to find a physical taking because you can't control who the tenant is. I just wonder how much of that survives Cedar Point's quite strong support for the right to exclude and interferences with it being a physical taking. I guess we think we have very good arguments on the regulatory take, the multi-factor regulatory taking side. On the other hand, one interesting, especially because we're at the motion to dismiss stage, we haven't had a chance to prove our case. The district judge said, I don't think that you can prove a sufficient diminution of value across the board. But our view is at the motion to dismiss stage, we've certainly alleged it. And we think that is possible because we think, given the way the other factors weigh, the diminution in value doesn't have to be that significant. And we think we can prove a minimum that will get all of these units into the regulatory taking stage. But one of the interesting interchanges in the Cedar Point argument, where the question really was, is this California regulation going to be evaluated as a physical taking, or are we going to subject it to the multi-factor regulatory takings test? And during the argument, I think there was candor on both sides in the lawyers on both sides basically saying, we don't know of a lot of cases where the regulatory takings test has ever been satisfied. Now, part of that is it's a multi-factor test. Part of that is pre-NIC, it was always state court judges doing the balancing. But I think it is the reality that test, at least up until now has been one that governments usually win because it's a multi-factor test and had been applied by state judges who may have been more reluctant to find a violation. So if I were the other side, I guess I would say that's my strongest, or I would say that's their strongest argument. I still think we would prevail, but it certainly is an area where state and local governments have done very well, which is why Cedar Point is so significant in making clear that physical takings is a more expansive category than I think some people thought before.
Yeah. Here's an anonymous question concerning the due process claim. There's no means testing for the regulated apartments. That's a question.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, you mentioned, it feels to me like you mentioned something about excluding or including high income tenants. Was that an amendment or has that been in place?
So the law, this law has evolved in different ways. And so there were older provisions, former provisions of the law that said if the tenant's income reaches a certain level or the rent reaches a certain level, then the controls fall off. They were separate, then they were combined, but now neither of them exist. So, in fact, you can be a millionaire or a billionaire and live in one of these apartments and get the benefit of the limitations that the law applies.
Yeah, that is fascinating to me. And is, at least for the due process part of the claim, is the city, do they have a fallback argument where they're saying at a minimum in terms of sort of maybe a constitutional avoidance argument, the court could only strip away that means, the evaporation of that means testing. They need to save the rest of the regulation.
Well, there never was any means testing. This was sort of an outer limit.
What they've basically
fallen back on is this neighborhood stability argument, that this is really about that stability of the neighborhood isn't about the property owner, it's about the tenant. And so having long continuity of tenants and this successorship right keeps things stable in neighborhoods, and they want to do that. Of course, that doesn't really answer why, although it doesn't happen very often, when the apartment becomes vacant, all these controls should still apply. But that's been the argument that they and the district court ended up focusing on, I think, because the other ones are so vulnerable.
Great. Well, and just maybe a yes or no, if you can, on this. Is this lawsuit cover the 2019 amendments, or does it cover more than that?
We cover the laws that exist today. So the 2019 amendments plus the existing law, our position is not that pre-2019 the law was constitutional. We don't think so.
Right,
but the 2019 law certainly has made our case stronger because of the much more draconian limitations that it enacted.
Very good. Very good. Well, I think we're out of time here, Andy, and I want to thank you for your time and your expertise. In case in the audience you missed the website, it's unlawfulrentregs.com. Have I got that right? Unlawfulrentregs.com.
Yes.
Unlawfulrentregs.com. My apologies to audience members who had questions who didn't get them answered. Maybe we can have you back, Andy, after the oral argument, or certainly at some point in the future. This is a fascinating case. I'd like to stay up on it and keep our members up on it as well.
So I'd be happy to, and thank you again.
Yeah, and to our audience, thank you for zooming in, I guess is the right term nowadays. Keep an eye on our website and your emails for future webinars. But until that next Zoom webinar, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.